This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents If an Egyptian Cannot Speak English by Noor Nega, narrated by Amin El Gemel and the author. I am not what you think I am. You are what you think I am. Instagram caption by @HannahPerlis, November 5th, 2016. Part 1. Question. If you don't have anything nice to say, should your mother be punished? And then mother placed a single peach on a saucer at the center of the table. With a carving knife, divided it in four. Dinner, she said. My grandmother, whose perfect teeth were singly stolen by a dentist working from his one room across the river, and seating patients on the bed he sleeps in, took all the peach quarters and squished them into her ears. Such greed, said mother, sucking the hollow seed. Father breathed. Swinging her elbows like a race walker, grandmother busied into the kitchen and climbed inside the stove. The next day they placed her collection of paper cranes into the ground with her. So I left. This was 10 years ago. The distance from Shubrakhit to Cairo is 140 kilometers. I took a microbus, then the train.
Question. Is it arrogant to return to a place you've never been? If I was a white girl with a shaved head, they probably wouldn't have cared. But because I was an Egyptian girl with a shaved head, they wouldn't let me forget it. Everything was fine at JFK, even when 400 Egyptians funneled into a Boeing 777 destined for Cairo. No one noticed me. For 12 hours, our heads nodded, lolled against one another as we dozed and dreamed, and there was no telling in the canned gloom who was who. Then the lights came on and we landed. These same 400 passengers disembarking on the other side seemed to have forgotten where we'd come from. They glared openly at me and muscled past in the aisle, suspicious all of a sudden. No one helped me get my backpack from the overhead bin. At passport control, the officer looked like a younger version of my father, slender, brown, and long-faced, with silver glasses that gave him a pained, glittering look of sensitivity. Behind me, the line was long and vocal, but he held my American passport leisurely in his hands, as if it were a book he had read before. He said my name, searched my face the way strangers study the daughters of a niqab-wearing woman, noting the texture of their hair, the pucker of their mouths, aging the children's faces and their minds, searching for the mother's beauty. It was clear that the officer was picturing me with hair. He was searching for the Egyptian in me, or possibly the illness. I wanted to say, same. I had filled out the boxes on the declaration form in a child's handwriting, articulating the tooth of every letter seen and dotting my diacritics individually. The effect was neat, but painstaking. What brings you here? He asked in Arabic. Do you have an Egyptian passport? I shook my head. National ID card? I said, pardon? He sent me out of the line and around the corner to another man who was very large, with purple eye rings, smoking cigarettes in a glass cubicle. He looked trapped in it, as if on display in a museum. This man finished his cigarette, brushing through my passport with his thumb, before asking in English, how long you stay? I tried to tell him I was staying for good. 6 months, okay? He asked. And I nodded because his English was poor, but my Arabic was poorer. He made a loop and a dash on a pink slip. Take this. You go that office up the stair. You pay, you come again here. I went up the stairs to the second office and there was no one there. When I returned to the man in the glass case, he shouted over his shoulder in Arabic, Dina! Go tell that son of a shoe to sit at the cashier. And shooed me with the back of his hand before I could explain. The son of a shoe looked about 14, with with matching purple eye rings, smiling. I paid him and returned to the smoking man, who sent me back to the passport control line with a paper visa in my hand. "Hey, American, come here." It was the officer from before, the one who looked like my father calling me to the front. All the other Egyptians glared at me as I moved apologetically up the queue. I wanted to explain that I was one of them, that I had been in line earlier and paid my dues, but my Arabic. The officer stamped my passport, winked, and let me through.
Question. If your mother wanted to feed you forever, why would she cut the cord? After my grandmother's death by oven, I knew I would leave Shubrachit for good. During the last conversation I had with mother, I said, "I'm going to Cairo." She sat tenderly supergluing the sole of her shoe back onto the heel. From behind her focus, she mumbled, "Cairo? Cairo. Is that beyond the pigeon tower?" I said yes. Her eyes watered from the chemical smell. "Son, is it beyond the hospital across the river?" I said, "Yes." And then added, "It's even beyond Demenhur." "What?" she gasped. "And there are people beyond Demenhur?" I hoisted a corn bag of clothes over my shoulder, the camera swinging around my neck. She lifted a hand to smooth back her hair, and the shoe, now glued to her thumb, went with it, bloodied her eye. I took a microbus from Shubrachit to Demenhur, and the fog was so thick we could not see even the dashed road lines. The driver steered with his whole head out the window. There was no one in the white air but us. I cried into my corn bag. For days after my grandmother cooked herself to death, mother didn't say it, but we knew anyway that she was sour from thinking, shame to waste the gas and not eat. The whole village knew she was wondering how best to divide a peach into thirds. From Demenhur, I took the train to Cairo, and inside it the air was very brown, like closet air. I fell asleep and woke up with a man feeling my thigh through my torn pocket. People think anyone with a camera will have coins instead of skin in his pocket. When I arrived at Ramses station in Cairo, the air was people. Nowhere you looked wasn't people. They clogged every street and then piled on top of each other in buildings 20 stories high. Many were not even Egyptian. You could turn into an alley and find 50 Sudanese men, bluer than black, with cheeks like shoulder blades and ankles like knives. Or else women as tall as I am, women so pale you could see rivered blood at their wrists and neck. I heard 20 Arabics in my first week. And wherever I went, people asked me, sometimes in English because of the hair, "Where are you from?" While one man was asking me this, another, whizzing by on motorcycle, stole a cigarette right out of my hand. While waiting my turn to order a sandwich, I saw children in school uniforms drowning kittens in a barrel of tar. A waitress my mother's age came up to me, clicking gum with an open mouth. "I like tall boys like you. Don't you want to kiss me?" My first year in Cairo, I still spoke country, referring to myself in the plural. "We do," I answered. She laughed in my face, led me by the hand to a garage, where she ran her tongue along my teeth and rubbed my knees. I was 19. This was 10 years ago, 2007. And since then, I've been home only once. Somewhere in Shubrachit, my mother is dividing all the dinner fruits in half.
Question. If the stampede is heading toward you, should you turn around and run? What they really want to know is whether my head is shaved because I have cancer or because I'm a pervert. Instead of this question, they ask another. What brings you here? I get it from all of them. The driver who picked me up from the airport with my name on cardboard. the one who works for my mother's former classmate, Sherry. The Fayumi doorman of the building downtown who took my bags up without asking, against my protests. Madame Fadia, the cleaning lady, who was waiting in the apartment to hand over the keys. Then a few days later, Sherry herself, a woman with a moist, cosmetically bloated face, who lives in Zamelik with her two tiny dogs. She is one of those desperate women, like my mother, who, the more effort they put into their appearance, the older they look. We sat on her balcony while a Sudanese maid came and went with tea, then sablé and petit four, then red and white wine, and I squirmed at the horror of being served by a black woman with a kerchief tied around her head. "What brings you to Cairo, dear?" Sherry asked. But before I could tell her, she had moved on. "I haven't seen your mother since 89, you know that? I don't blame her. It's not a good time to be here. A few years ago, okay, I could understand. Post-revolution, everyone was coming back all excited. Ask me where they are now." I looked at her blankly. She made pedaling cycles with her cigarette hand until I recited, "Where are they now?" Then she continued as though I hadn't. £20 to the dollar. This is the exchange rate today. A year ago it was 8. Tell your mother I miss her." The resemblance between them was uncanny, actually. The same vanity, the femme fatalism, the overpowering smell of creams and powders. You just knew she spent too much time alone in front of mirrors, crying. I had not spoken to my mother since I left New York, where she'd been grilling me almost hourly. "Why are you going there?" Now that I have gone there, the question has folded on itself, put a foot in its mouth. Why have you come here? This is the first thing people ask when they meet me, and their tone is more indignant than inquisitive. The more they discover, the more offended they are. "You live in America? Have American passport? Do you know what people here would give for an American passport? We are all trying to leave and you have the option to be there, but instead, why are you here?" I try to explain that America is not heaven, that there are problems everywhere. "Trump," I say, but it is the wrong thing to say to the driver, to the doorman. Madame Fadia, the cleaning lady, was the only one who believed me and seemed pleased to hear it. "The people are warmer here, kinder, more humane," I continued, as though I had been in Cairo for longer than 4 hours when I met her and could possibly have an opinion. She was excited by this, wanted me to elaborate, which I did. "Egyptians are warmer," she repeated after me when I was done, and her relief was palpable, as if I had confirmed a private fantasy she had been cultivating for years. "I've never been interested in traveling outside myself. Some of my brothers work in Saudi. They always say it is cleaner outside and the money's good, but I've never wanted to leave. No place is better than any other. We only think it is." I agreed with Madame Fadia initially. She was agreeing with me, after all. But the longer she spoke, the more uncomfortable I grew. I started to think she was gullible and dim-witted for treating my account without skepticism. After all, I was skeptical myself. Why was I in Cairo? When I first told my father I was going to Cairo, he changed the subject, pretended not to have heard me. A few days later, I called him at the office in Midtown because he so rarely came home anymore. He cleared his throat, as though fatherhood had just been declared carcinogenic, and he wanted nothing to do with it. He was doing a cleanse. He was detoxing. He had given up gluten and dairy and daughters. "Venus is in retrograde," he said. "We feel a strong impulse to break out of cycles we've been trapped in for years. Moving across the Atlantic may not be the answer, though." When I pressed him about his own running, from his marriage, from his family, he said with finality, "I can't make this decision for you." Which was typical. My mother was no more helpful. "I've decided to go to Cairo after graduation," I told her, from the other end of the tuxedo couch in our living room. "You really don't know what you're saying," she snapped. The next morning at breakfast, she began to cry. "You're leaving me? How can you leave me with everything I'm going through?" A week later, she became cruel. "Let me guess, she began to say, every few hours apropos of nothing. You want to connect with your roots. Two air quotes around the word roots. My parents left Cairo in the 80s and never looked back. When I arrived at the apartment on Mahmoud Basyuni Street, I realized my mother had gone through my suitcase and removed all my sweatpants and short shorts and slides, adding a few dragging dresses still minty with the tags and many shawls. This is her love language. She'd arranged everything, Sherry's driver to pick me up from the airport, an apartment sublet in my name downtown, a job for me at the British Council teaching English. It couldn't have been easier, but it has not been easy.
Question. How far can you run from home before you run out of water? The first few years in Cairo were shit. I had a little money my grandmother had squirreled away for me. She used to crochet bridal doilies and sell them in Alexandria. All her life, she told me I would eat from her hands one day. I would eat with this lace. And I did. On the microbus from Shubrakhit to Damanhur, I found £4,000 folded between my camera lens and its cap. When had she? The day of the oven? The day she. I cried into my corn bag. Someone sitting at the back called me a feeding horse. Someone else laughed. I thought I would die on that microbus in the clean white air. I thought I had cried until I fogged up all the roads going anywhere, that I'd never again see beyond my outstretched arms. Those first few years in Cairo, I lived off my grandmother's lacework and said a prayer for her every night. I enrolled at the University of Cairo in mass communications and made some money assisting cameramen on low-budget commercials and sometimes porn. It was hand-to-mouth for years, degrading, impossibly desolate. Then, revolution.
Question. Is science enough to explain why you see a mirage when you're dying of thirst? I arrived in June. My first month in Cairo, I kept mistaking strangers for family. Everywhere I looked, I saw my parents and my sister Lulu. In the bars of downtown Cairo, especially Zigzag, any of the curly-haired girls with enormous glassy doll eyes could be Lulu. My mother was every hefty tant in tassel fringe capris, pointed toe mules, and my father was the same cricket-legged bald man serving me coffee, driving me home. In my first week of teaching English at the British Council, I even called one of my students Baba by accident, to the class's uproarious delight. I'd never done anything like that before. When I told Sammy about the incident, he quipped with Oedipal reasoning that I must be in love with a student. Sammy is the nephew of my program coordinator at the British Council, and I met him at Café Riche downtown. He is blonde, straight, overweight, with frameless glasses that were fashionable in the early 2000s, but now aged him by 2 decades at least. A virgin. He introduced me to Reem, clearly gay, clearly smitten, and the two of them cheerfully adopted me. They were both pop culture junkies and conspirators, whose fiery friendship was often mistaken for romance by the unimaginative clientele at Riche, sighing old ladies with their cheeks in their hands. To be fair, they were inseparable. The first day I met them, they were rehearsing an old debate over who killed Suad Hosni. Reem was making chopping motions on the table with the edge of her hand, constructing a timeline using the salt and pepper shakers. Sammy let her talk until she had climbed to a breathless climax before calmly introducing a hypothetical. Why would intelligence murder her in the most telltale way possible? And Reem lost it. She stood up and began to shout, leaning over the table, using her whole body to gesticulate. And I suppose you think Ashraf Marwan was suicidal too. If she wanted to kill herself, why choose someone else's balcony? Why fly all the way to London? They killed her. They killed her in the exact same apartment complex in London where they killed Ashraf Marwan because she was going to write her memoirs and expose them all. Witnesses saw men in suits throw Saad Husni from the balcony, and I waved a hand in front of Reem's face. Who's Saad Husni? I asked. Reem's and Sami's faces sprang open simultaneously. They blinked. It was the nicest gift I could have given them. I'd never seen two people so horrified with joy. Oh, honey, said Reem, as though seeing me properly for the first time. She collapsed back into her chair. You know her, said Sami kindly. You know her for sure. She was in the 60s film, Isharat Hub. I shook my head, but he kept nodding. You know her. You'd know her if you saw her. Khali Belak Minzuzu? I shook my head, but they were both delighted. He opened up his laptop and we all watched Khali Belak Minzuzu on YouTube, Sami pausing to point out the most iconic scenes, while Reem looked up memes of the film, both of them singing along to the songs. The other customers stared at us, and I thought we might be kicked out of Café Riche, but no one complained. I realized only as I came to leave that Sami's father was the owner, that no one who sat with Sami at the table ever paid, and that he himself never left that table. As long as the café was open, Sami had to be there, keeping an eye on the cashier and the servers and the guests, who he said tried to pocket the vintage Stella ashtrays whenever he went to the bathroom. He was 21, smoking LM cigarettes, drinking beers from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., in the same chair at the same table every day, bored out of his mind.
Question. If everyone you knew jumped off a bridge, wouldn't you believe you could fly? If you weren't there, I can't tell you what it was like. To wake up from a dream you have been dreaming since birth is powerful. But to wake up from a dream you have been dreaming from birth with almost 100 million people, brothers and strangers alike, a collective nightmare, a nightmare we had been imbibing all our lives and passing around to one another, feeding innocently to our newborns, that we are worthless, that we deserve no better than the filth we live in. If there is a judgment day, this was it. We rose from our graves, patted the dirt off each other, looked each other in the eye. An entire population crawling out of a mass grave to hold those who'd buried us accountable, and in doing so, daring to imagine another reality. It doesn't have to be like this, my neighbor told me, and when I repeated this idea to my other neighbor, it doesn't have to be like this, I heard him pass it on in a voice that was louder than mine. We took heart from one another. As with every command from the natural world, the timing was right. All over the country, red-breasted birds appear at the first rain after the long summer, what we call in Shubr Khit the date-washing rain. Every April, termites hatch like clockwork, conquering whole neighborhoods with their organization. In January of 2011, we too came out of the ground by the thousands, like a natural phenomenon. It was not a political coming of age, or even an ideological one. We didn't take to the streets out of anger, but out of pride. For some of us, it was the first time in our lives we believed in our own capacity for goodness or heroism. I was in the square every day, documenting what we were already calling revolution, and the world was all eyes. Cairo was flooded with foreigners, journalists, translators, activists, academics. It had never happened before that the global epicenter tipped in our direction. Suddenly, America was watching us. In its gaze, we became a collective, demonstrative, intentional. We wanted to show them who we were. Each of us in the square had our work and felt it keenly. There were the organizers, the drummers, the journalists, lawyers, medics, poets, artists, those who distributed food and water, those who brought tents to share, those who warned us of spies and informers, and the informers themselves who failed to blend in. I had the digital camera then, and I sold CNN my frames for £2,000 apiece, close-ups taken on the ground, and aerial shots from various balconies. All this before drones made it so much easier. I sold my work to the BBC, too, and to Reuters. I felt that my entire life had been a preparation for this exact purpose, that I was fulfilling my grandmother's prophecies, avenging the senselessness of her death and the teeth someone, but who, had pried from her mouth. The cheapness of the burial, the wooden marker on her grave fading fast instead of the marble plaque she deserved, carved and inked to resist the weather. Everyone in the street had a personal grievance. There was a woman we called Mama Batta, whose only son had been abducted by the secret police at age 16. When they found the body, his fingers and toes had been severed and sewn on again. The toes on the hands and the fingers on the feet. She carried his photo on a wooden sign. There were microbus drivers and mechanics, pharmacists, upholsterers, plumbers, farmers, shopkeepers, accountants, academics, all with photos of their loved ones too. This one dead from a curable disease. This one from suicide. This one in a building that collapsed. There was Uncle Susu, whose kidney had been stolen on the desert road, and a landowner from Mansoura, who had had 20 acres of good farmland sequestered by the army without compensation. In 2011, we really believed we were birthing a new order, that everything would change, and the corruption that had seeped through the veins of the nation, poisoning every organ, would be flushed out. At last. 6 years later. It's embarrassing to remember just how innocent we were. Not naive so much as innocent. Those who are gunned down without even a crowbar in their hands to defend themselves, we called martyrs and repeated their names and hung posters of their faces everywhere we could, determined that their bloodshed would not be in vain. We believed, we really believed, that the revolution would succeed on the strength of our brotherhood. And the nobility of our cause. Had we been less occupied with documenting the losses, circulating names and dates, video footage, we might have noticed earlier that everything was not as it seemed. There was money pouring in from overseas, along with vested interests. We thought we were toppling a regime, but the whole world was involved. It seems so obvious now, but if you weren't there, you can't possibly judge. I can't tell you what it was like.
Question. How many questions can you ask before you expose who you are? I'm caught between my desire to understand and my desire to appear as though I already understand. In the mornings, the shopkeepers and doormen are all out on the street, thrashing water on the gravel, making mud of the dust. So when I trail through on my way to work, my hems are browned. What's that about? Do they imagine they're cleaning? There are manhole covers chained to dumpsters and dumpsters chained to lampposts. Who is stealing which and what for? On every corner, a man sells corn. A man squats on the ground, fanning corn, bedded into the coals of a tin box, and yet I've never seen anyone either buying or eating corn. There are women balancing loads the size of washing machines on their heads, winding calmly through the traffic, arms by their sides. Everyone walks in the road instead of on the sidewalk. Fresh bread is bicycled through the traffic on enormous baker's trays. There is a long pig snort, a snore sound they call shakhra, that people make when incredulous, the equivalent of an eye roll. There are ordinary things missing in the supermarket. Baking soda, chocolate chips, tampons, fresh milk. There are goats in the road, chickens and rabbits and ducks in spindly wooden crates. If I keep my mouth closed, I can almost pass for a Kyrene. People look me up and down. They talk to me in Arabic and I feel I've won something. When I start asking questions, they switch immediately to English, as though correcting themselves, putting us both in our places. Cairo is not what I expected. But the shock is one of scale rather than content. I expected traffic and poverty and pollution, but not like this. It's a city dialed up to its extreme. Sammy and Reem had to teach me how to cross the road and live. They each held one of my hands and we practiced. If there are lines on the roads, I've never seen them. Just swarms of cars, each lunging forward, wherever a foot of tarmac is visible, horns blaring, the drivers hanging their elbows out the windows, sweating, swearing at one another. Compared to New York, this is a real place where real things happen. Not microaggressions that are tweeted about, not theory. These are adult aggressions, bodily, bloodying. The beggars are missing arms or legs and come up to tap on the glass, show you their stumps, open their mouths to show you no tongue. They wipe the windshields with rags. Children, 8 or 9 years old, pull carts over potholes, look for plastic in the garbage piles, or sell socks and balloons on the corniche. You buy a balloon and the child eats, or you don't buy a balloon. It's sensory overload with nowhere to hide. It's consequence. When I Skype my mother during rush hour, she keeps asking me where I am because it's so loud she can hardly hear me, but I am inside, Mama, with all the doors and windows shut. Call me again after 11 p.m. Maybe then you'll hear me.
Question. If this one cigarette was 2 cigarettes a year ago, where did the second cigarette go? When the foreigners left, it all went to shit. When it all went to shit, the foreigners left. The sequence hardly matters. The result was the same. They took their work and their money and their drugs with them when they left. Even the Egyptians who flooded back in from abroad in 2011 in hopes of rebuilding the country have since given up and returned to wherever they came from. At some point after the Rabaa massacre of 2013, after the sugar crisis and the floating of the Egyptian pound last November, after it became clear that all the men who had disappeared from their beds at night for tweeting were not going to be released, the unthinkable happened. People began to long for the days of Hosni Mubarak. He was a thief, but at least the economy was flourishing, they began saying. The wheel of production didn't stop once in his reign. He didn't lead us into any wars. He built bridges. It's been 6 years since the revolution, and the pound is worth a third of what it was worth in 2011, depreciating so fast that none of the shopkeepers put prices on their goods anymore. You have to hold up every can of Fool individually, every pack of Cleopatra, and ask, how much is this today?
Question. If one day all the other carpenters start calling you a queen, how many hammers will you need? I first met the boy from Shubrakhit at Cafe Riche in downtown Cairo. I was there because I had nowhere else to go after work. On the street, my shaved head made me an easy target. Everyone had something to say. Women giggled. Men shouted from the backs of motorcycles and the interiors of cars. But in Café Riche, with Sami and Reem, I felt semi-intelligible. They had Instagram references to understand the buzz cut, the one-inch coffin nails I came with, my crew socks with Nike slides. In fact, they didn't just understand me. They competed for my attention like spaniels, always yapping appreciatively about how clean I was. Clean being code for more than just money, a coveted un-Egyptianness. A combination of first-world contact and old-world etiquette. Reem herself was clean because she was French-educated, lived in Garden City. Sammy was clean because half-British by blood. Café Riche was clean because it had air conditioning, a menu in English and French, exorbitant prices, waiters dressed in the jester-like costumes of Nubians. Kalthoum herself used to perform on its small outdoor stage. You can order a glass of wine with your meal, but not shisha. All the tablecloths have the original Stella star on them, and on the walls there are photographs of the celebrities who used to frequent the place. Café Riche is over 100 years old, and it is clean. The three of us were sitting around in its garish white lighting. They were teaching me how to play backgammon when the boy from Shubrakhit entered. Freakishly tall. Ducking to avoid a concussion on the doorframe. He was dressed in suspenders, a frayed polka-dotted bow tie, and most touchingly, black socks inside black schoolboy sandals. Sat beside me and twitched for the entire hour, jiggling his rounded knees, stretching his neck, cracking his knuckles in quick, unnatural succession. I'd never seen such restlessness. Even his quiet voice was quickly quiet, the way flies and roaches are, a twitch. He scrunched a cigarette butt into his plate and immediately lit another. Scrunched that, lit another. I watched his automatic fingers and saw with my bedroom eye the cigarette sizzling out, head first, against a nipple. I borrowed his spoon to eat the coffee grounds at the bottom of my Turkish cup. "Isn't it bitter?" he asked in a cool, pattering Arabic I could barely catch. "Is bitter bad?" I answered shyly. He asked me what I played, meaning what I did, then lifted the grimy analog camera hanging around his neck to indicate his own answer. In the months I knew him, I never saw evidence of his photography and believed him solely because he didn't try to shoot me as they all do, didn't say the line they all say, preying on the conceit of women. "Your bones were made for a lens." It was because he never asked that I eventually stripped and lay down on the kitchen tiles of my L-shaped apartment, commanding in my lilting, infantile Arabic, "Take me from above."
Question. If a girl misremembers the first time she saw you, can you ever truly fill her eyes? I saw the American girl's ankles first. I recognized the foreignness in their brown angularity. Before I could arrange my body in response to this realization, the rest of her had descended from the ceiling, down the steps, into the basement stationery shop. Petite, expensive-looking clothes, and hair shaved close to the scalp like a sniper's. I was seated, blocking most of the narrow space, but she swept past, over, me, her flying silk dress licking my knees. She had me trapped on the floor. Nowhere to go. Right behind her were the kids from Rish, Reem, the lesbian with a starched ironed polo shirt, and Sammy, sweating fatly, his rimless eyeglasses sliding down his nose. She stood looking at the leather notebooks, throwing words over her shoulder at them in horrific English, while I sat, poor boy down on the tiles near her ankles, in the shop that was also underground. Vain, obviously vain. She left without buying anything, the same sweeping silk on my feet and knees before she floated up the stairs, ascended into the world. "This is the dress you were wearing in the stationery shop," I would remind her on the day I finally peeled it off her body. Her answer? "What shop?" She had not seen me at all. Until now, she thinks we met for the first time 2 weeks later, at Café Riche, when she borrowed my spoon.
Question. If a man's anger is lovelier than his loveliness, what kind of ending do you expect? In Café Riche, Reem follows me with her technical eye. Reem irons her underwear. She threads her eyebrows using a ruler, will not bite into food that is multicolored or multi-textured. She makes murals for a living and showed them to me on her phone. There were no curves, just lines everywhere, and the intersections shaded like a building plan. "People pay for this?" I asked, and Sammy interrupted with his usual smirk.
"They pay very well."
When we first met, Reem's entire right arm was in a cast that she scrubbed with a kitchen sponge twice a day to keep it gleaming. She was mildly concussed. When we met the second time, she did not remember me and was turned on all over again by the angles of my jaw. To Sammy, she whispered, "Like Sausan Badr." And the bones of my fingers, picture them fisting. According to Sammy, since her accident, she'd fallen from the scaffolding on a job. Reem is less inhibited and eats with her left hand like an infidel.
"But you're left anyway, aren't you, Reemo?"
Sammy teased. Left meaning loose, meaning sexed and liberal. Reem lowered her eyes as if in prayer. I do the Lord's work. She turned to me and flicked her tongue. Who else do you know that eats so someone else can get full? The boy from Shubrakhid smiled into his cigarette, and Sami tooted. Madam, this is a respectable establishment. That day in Rish, the four of us were sitting at the usual table at the front, when a crowd of girls with bad makeup and tight hijabs giggled in. They were dressed in leggings under knee-length skirts, plaid dresses over turtlenecks and other layered combinations that I was only beginning to realize were indicative of no money, and therefore no mobility, a here-ness no one would forgive. The kinds of clothes worn by the kinds of people who would not be called clean by either Sami or Reem. Sami, who I'd never seen actually address a customer before, rounded both chins on the girls and asked them, without rising from his seat, "Cafe or restaurant?" The girl at the front froze mid-step, and the others clashed into her, the whole group swaying forward and snapping back before she said, "Sorry?" I saw her glance at the backgammon board on our table, unsure who we were supposed to be, what authority we had. Sami repeated loudly, "Are you looking for a cafe or a restaurant?" Beside me, the boy from Shubrakhid stopped twitching for the first time all night, the better to listen, it seemed. He picked his camera up off the table with one hand and his knuckles whitened around it. I pictured him bringing it down like a brick on Sammy's snub nose. "Cafe?" one of the other girls said finally. "This is a restaurant," Sami answered. And then he eyed them above the dimes of his spectacles until they left.
Question. Why ask a question that has no answer unless you want someone's tongue in your hand? That blubber tub Sami was at it again. Every time I go to Rish, he pulls a stunt like this. Turns customers away at the door because they're too visibly broke. "Cafe or restaurant?" he asked. And whatever the girls had answered would have been the wrong answer. They were unwelcome. It boils my blood. I can't tell if he believes this class is dog shit or if the whole performance is a flex just for me, to degrade me or remind me that we are not the same, even if it's he who owes me money. I would have stormed out if the American girl weren't also there witnessing the scene with an expression of confusion on her sharp face. She didn't seem to understand. And I waited for a chance to explain it to her. I went to the bathroom and finished off the red pills that are the only thing keeping me together right now. I must look it, too. When I left home this morning, all the dealers on the street were coming up to me mumbling, "Want strawberries, boss? Want kimia?" Street names for tramadol. And I must be shaking without realizing it. I must have a look already if they are coming up to me in these numbers in broad daylight. The American girl was watching me when I returned. As soon as I sat down, she lifted my spoon off my saucer and began to diddle with the coffee grounds at the base of her cup. Then, without ado, she put the head in her mouth. More than a pee for intimacy, this, I thought, was a gesture of solidarity. Later, when we were alone on the street, she asked me if Sami didn't want Muslims in Rish because his family was Coptic. Adorable. They don't hate Muslims. They hate the poor, I laughed. She was shocked. And I was very pleased. Perhaps had it not been for this moment, we would never have come to love each other. But it was the look on her face in the grim street light. I could see her multiplying that small injustice 100 times over, calculating its true scale across a lifespan. She was from America, rich, obviously. But it seemed she could still be horrified by the wanton exercise of power. And this singled her out from the others. I felt somehow that she was on my side.
Question. When is a confession of addiction not a foreshadowing? At closing time, when Sami gets up to count the money in the cash register, the boy from Shubrakhid waits for Reem to leave Cafe Rish. Then when she's gone, he invites me for a walk.
You can tell a photographer's skill by his grip. He informs me excitedly. But his grip is unorthodox. He wraps his right hand around the camera from the front, fingers curling over the top as though it were a pull-up bar. Practices shooting but doesn't actually click. He lunges, crouches, kneels, holding positions for whole minutes with his eye on the plus sign, his pointer finger on the shutter he has not released in years. He says nothing steadies the hand like cocaine. During the revolution, everyone was itching and scratching anyway, lice being unavoidable. He says lice lived even in their mustaches and pubes. You could travel with your own tent on your back, but you could not control who came and slept once it was unfolded. He himself hardly slept. Back in 2011, a single line could keep him awake for 3 days. The drugs were passed out with the sandwiches and water and vinegar and yeast. Boys as young as 12 were emptying cigarettes in order to stuff them with warmed hashish, loose tobacco, or else begging to lick the wrist someone else had snorted off. He says nothing makes for revolution like cocaine. He has been clean now for 17 days. Every sneeze joggles the brain inside his skull, so he has learned to stop sneezing, closes his nostrils with one hand, and flutters his lips like a horse when he feels a sneeze coming. He has nerves growing straight out of his scalp. He cannot rub his fingers through his own hair, it hurts. His eyelashes hurt. He blinks violently. His bones hurt. His left leg, he complains, is full and wet with sand. Says he will shoot again one day and he needs to be ready. Carries the camera around his neck wherever he goes. Says he will never shoot again. Laughing, switches to English and shrugs out the words I translated for him myself just hours ago when he found out I was an English teacher. What's the point?
Question. Can a man and a woman fetishize each other in equal measure? Or must one always be outdone by the other? I tell the American girl with the shaved head that you either smoke, snort, or inject. Strict matter of preference. No more shame in one than in another. But there is a natural progression. Smoking is stupid slow, also less economical. There is a frustration all the time over the fumes you do not catch in the lungs, the expensive drug diffusing visibly in the air. It is sentimental for most of us. Reminiscent of innocent, thrilled beginnings. Protest. Conspiracy, army tank graffiti, tear gas and tent sex, downtown house parties full of sweating journalists and mahraganat, the Italian orgies in Aguza. All the foreigners were here to fuck. I would step into rooms like a drop of oil in a glass of milk, like an open drain. The women immediately began to circle me. When they realized I spoke no English, no French, no German, when they realized I spoke only Arabic, it seemed to answer a question they had been asking since they arrived in Egypt, land of coal-eyed pharaohs and fallahin. They wanted someone unpolluted by modernity, an illiterate, straight from the village, with rough hands and hair of black lamb's wool, sexual hang-ups inherited with bestial customs. They wanted me to loom above them, dark and merciless. They paid for everything and laughed when I would not take off my shirt or pants. But it pleased them even more to be naked while I was dressed, to be prone while I stood pounding between their white legs. These older women, who had not learned how to say thank you or bless your hands for this meal in Arabic, would beg me in monstrous accents, "Nikni, nikni." Not once did I lower my head beneath waist level to pleasure them. I even told them that in Shubrachit we never kiss, to avoid having to bear their lips on mine. I took what I could from them and moved on. For many of us, once the sit-ins were over and the foreigners fled and the sex lost its variety, it became impossible to smoke. Snorting cocaine, you taste it through your nose, and the bitterness will convince you, if you had any doubts left, that this budra is poison. The naked tongue shrivels in its bed. but snorting remains most practical in public. Any time, any place, little attention needed. I once snorted off my wrist in the middle of a street in Zemelek. By the time passers-by had swallowed their shock, I was powerfully gone. A needle in the neck, though? I take a needle in the neck, or sometimes the back of the hand, or occasionally, but not for many years now, the classic forearm. The vein knows before the skin is broken what is coming. I swear, the vein begins to swell and thump like a cock, the heart already heroic before the tip enters. Once in, the force is immediate. I could jump off the 6th of October bridge. I could wrestle an airplane to the ground. The first day I spoke to the American girl was also the first day I deprived myself of a needle in the neck. Coincidentally, no relation. Having made my decision the night before, I was terrified of being left alone in my shack, with the peeling walls and roaches, the pain, a mushroom cloud of nuclear devastation in slow motion behind my eyes. I went to Rish to see Sammy about my money, but the American from the stationery shop was there too. She was the only one not smoking, sitting with her regal back straighter than a door, while Sammy and the lesbian blew smoke in her face. They were playing backgammon. She borrowed my spoon to eat the coffee grounds at the bottom of her cup. And we could all see from the peach plump wetness of her lips how the skin of her other lower lips would look. Her Arabic was cute, barely there. I could hear her crawling through the language, using expressions I hadn't heard since my own childhood. She handed me back the spoon, and the metal head was sucked as clean as the tail. She was hairless, I believed, all over.
Question. If the shoe doesn't fit, should you change the foot? The day after I met the boy from Shubrakhit, I tried to ask Reem why Sammy hadn't let those girls into Rish. What girls? She asked. The ones that came in the other night. You remember, we were all sitting right here. We were sitting right there, at the table by the door. Oh, the girls with the hijabs, she exclaimed, just as Sammy returned from the kitchen. What girls? Asked Sammy. The girls wearing skin-colored Karinas under their dresses, Reem winked. Oh, the girls wearing dresses over their jeans, he asked. The girls with Karinas under dresses over stonewashed jeans. The ones in high-heeled clogs? The ones with Huawei phones? It was a joke they were passing back and forth. They were laughing. I wanted to vomit. What about them? Said Reem when she and Sammy were done, but I felt sick. In New York, this would have been my cue to leave. I know the rules. I know what is correct, when to attack and who to defend. Once on the A train coming home, I saw a hijabi woman get spit on by a drunk, and I raised so much hell the whole car turned with me. Someone called the cops, and three Knicks fans on their way to a game surrounded the spitter, who was by this point slurring expletives, getting violent. Someone was filming, and the video went viral before I'd even seen it. It's how I got my Twitter handle, @spitonme, and became someone people recognized on the street and at clubs. But in Rish, I didn't leave. I just sat and drank Stella's with Sammy and Reem until closing time, and then walked home, worried that people on the street could smell the beer on me. When I left New York initially, I had thought Cairo would mean a dry chapter in my life. I wasn't expecting to find alcohol here, but in Rish, everyone has a glass in their hand. There are bars all over the city. When I went to Reem's studio, where she makes high-end stencil art for a living, she had all her empty liquor bottles displayed on a windowsill in a ray of sunshine. Later, at two separate house parties that she dragged me to with designs of seducing me, I noticed similar empty bottles arranged like trophies in the living rooms of first a filmmaker and then a journalist at Reuters, both well into their 30s. They treated it as a point of pride, even a form of activism, to drink despite so much flagrant religiosity everywhere else. Am I convinced by this? I don't know. In New York, alcohol isn't radical, doesn't set you against the grain or expose you to hatred the way wearing a hijab does or praying on the grass in Central Park. so it's disorienting now to be in a city where every Friday mats are rolled out onto the street and businesses close up so the men can pray under the sun. Are those that don't participate? Those who drink and sport tattoos? Men with earrings, girls with shaved heads? Discriminated against? Sure, we're outnumbered, but are we persecuted? Or is it the hijabis who are not allowed in clean restaurants and hotel swimming pools, as I learned from one of my students' essays, the ones I should stand up and defend? I am outside of my context, confused about where the margins and the pressure points are. Who has the power? Where is the center? I haven't seen a woman's knees since I got here, and no one has seen my knees either. There is Quran playing everywhere, and people drag God's name into every conversation. Every time I get into a cab, I am given a sermon by the driver about the wrongness of women looking like men. And why don't I cover up my head, seeing as I don't have hair anyway? But when I leave the car, having paid less than a dollar for a half-hour ride, I am confused about my right to offense, just as I'm confused about drinking as an act of resistance. There's something entitled about it. Yes, there is something rich.
Question: have I gone blind because of the dark? Or is it dark because I've gone blind? I text the American with the shaved head. She does not answer. I text for days and she does not answer. The vanity of this woman. Meanwhile, my body avenges itself. 6 years of budra in my bloodstream, and now all the pain I have not been feeling is slamming into me, compounded like, you dog, what is yours will always come for you. In the rooftop shack where I have been living for 6 years, I pace around, naked, too uncomfortable to sit or dress. Every stitch on my back chafes me individually. When I eventually collapse onto the bed, I dream of Magdi. Though I have never seen him, no one sees Magdi. He doesn't answer unknown numbers. A dealer's phone is worth its weight in heroin. I once saw a different dealer sell his SIM card for £200,000, back when that was a filthy number. But Magdi will never sell his phone. He'll live on a few loyals for the rest of his life. I dream of Magdi's voice, his effeminate, cream-white, "Hello?" fuller than a question. In the dream, I ask for more budra than I could ever afford. I hear myself say 12 grams. And Magdi breathes on the line like my father does in Shubrakhit, breathing things he'll never say. He breathes for minutes while I plead, "Magdi, I'm good for it, Magdi. I'm good for it. I need 12 grams tonight." I pull fists of leaves out of both pockets. I pull hairs from my head for payment. A dirty clown ribbon 10 meters long comes out of my throat and I'm gagging. Good for it. I wake up drowning in my own bed, the sheets heavy with sweat, swaddling me. I kick until I fall off my mattress and the concrete greets me like a shore. I roll on the ground until the pain subsides, then I text the American. Photography is a gorgeous corpse turning on the first night in its bed of soil. Photography is a shawl caught on the finger of a gnarled eternal olive tree. Photography is not about victory. Victory is viler, baser than the loll of a child's head on that child's own chest.
Question: is romance just a father who never carried you to bed, carrying you, at last, to bed? The boy from Shubrakhit began to text me relentlessly. I wasn't encouraging, but leaving him on read, which would have been so communicative to any New Yorker, he didn't register as rejection. Or possibly he understood but did not consider rejection an obstacle. Every day I woke up to verses of poetry, likely his own. Whimsical invitations, compliments, videos on YouTube, until in a small way I began to look forward to them. He sent me origami tutorials, clips from experimental German films of the 60s and 70s, Bhangra playlists, Palestinian newspaper coverage of World War I, from a digital archive I'd never heard of, and then, from the same year, scanned diary pages of an Armenian in Alexandria, a schoolgirl describing the boys she admired from church. I was surprised that someone like him could have such eclectic tastes, that he could be historically inclined and access a larger world through the cracked screen of his outdated phone. I couldn't help but wonder if he'd cobbled together this collection just for me to prove he could. The first night we walked around downtown together, his voice had struck me as street, sweaty, full of scrap iron. But then he texted in an Arabic that was formal, even classical. I said to Reem, who was always smoking somewhere nearby when I got these messages, that I couldn't tell if I was being courted by an Azhar Sheikh or a news reporter. Reem tried to ask what I meant, looking hurt and longing in that way she did when we were alone. She was in love with me. Her own texts consisted entirely of memes. I ruffled her hair. She flattened it again. Arabic. This language that had only ever existed for me in kitchens and bedrooms, baby talk, breakfast chatter, Eid mornings at Jim Cum Mosque, before my father converted to astrology, goodnight kisses after Kalila Udimna, or fever talk when I was feverish at age 5. Now, 20 years later, I realize I have never been loved by a man the way my father once loved me. The boy from Shubrakhit's hot wires and intimacy just by sounding like him. He wishes me not a good morning, but a childlike morning, or a morning of flowers. He texts, "I hope your day will be like the birds. I hope your night will be like the childhood of trees. Don't be sad, my moon. I have a remembering of the lives I didn't live." His texts also consist of theoretical